I'm the service aware of the children's message. I think the only children here are my children. Childish? Mark, please, no, no, no. Because if it's just my kids, it looks like we rehearsed this. So Mark, you're gonna, Mark and Emma will play the part of children. Go ahead and sit down. You're totally big. This is going to be more chaotic than usual. Okay, Emma, do you want to introduce? What's your name?
Ma.
And your name is?
Owen.
Wait. Are you coming back?
My name is Benjamin.
Okay. So you guys might need to help out Emma.
Okay.
Right, I have two things in my pocket. You tell me what they are. And think about what's different between them. You ready? Okay. Do you know what this is?
Something?
Okay, what is this?
It's a calculator.
It's a calculator. Let me hold the microphone. Okay, you ready for the next thing, Emma?
Yeah.
What's this?
Something.
Something? What's this, Benjamin?
A phone.
Okay, now really think about it. What's the difference between these two things?
This one is powered by light.
That one's powered by light. Is there a... They're actually both powered by batteries. What's another difference between them? What can this do?
The calculator, its main purpose, I'm pretty sure you could use it for other things, but its main purpose is to solve mathematical problems, basically.
And if they're, can you do that on the phone too?
Yes, but okay. you can't do some other things that are on the phone on the calculator.
If there was a new kind of math that they invented tomorrow, that you invented tomorrow, could you make this calculator do that?
Depends.
Could you give me a yes or no answer?
I can't say. It would really depend on what kind of math it was.
Can you add a new button to this calculator? Let's try that.
No.
No. Okay. But can you add a new button on the screen of this?
You can't really, like, zoop, new button. You can't really do that, but you can program something new onto the phone.
Okay. So the difference that I'm going for is the things that you could do with this calculator are fixed. And what are they on the phone? Fixed or changeable?
Changeable.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now we'll sing you to your class. Go down in peace, go down in peace. May the spirit of love surround you. Now in peace, go. Oh, Emily Rose is up there. Spirit of love surround you everywhere. And now we'll do a reading from the hymnal, number 444. You all read the italic parts. This house is for the ingathering of nature and human nature.
It is a house of friendships, a haven in trouble, an open room for the encouragement of our struggle.
It is a house of freedom, guarding the dignity and worth of every person.
It offers a platform for the free voice, for declaring both in times of security and danger, the full and undivided conflict of opinion.
It is a house of truth-seeking, where scientists can encourage devotion to their quest, where mystics can abide in a community of searchers.
It is a house of art, adorning its celebrations with melodies and handiworks.
It is a house of prophecy, outrunning times past and times present in visions of growth and progress.
This house is a cradle for our dreams, the workshop of our common
So today I'm going to talk about open source software and specifically my experience with it and how I think it relates to our Unitarian Universalist principles. The origin point for today's service is something that a friend of mine named Tim O'Brien wrote about 2 years ago. And he was recounting a conversation about the end of the manned space program, and this will come back and be interesting in a minute. So where someone said, our generation, so Tim and I are a year or two apart, hasn't done anything like land someone on the moon. We used to do big things. In fact, this is something that you hear a lot of people my age say, is bemoaning the slacker nature of our generation. And Tim's response was that this was utterly false. And his example is a single piece of computer software that, to his quote, is the largest and most complex collaborative effort in the history of our species. And this one project, which is coincidentally used extensively by NASA, private space companies, is actually in a lot of the phones in your pockets, is the product of nearly 1,300 individuals, all collaborating together around the world. Now, frankly, I'm not particularly interested in the question of whether Linux, which is the project that Tim is referring to, is or is not more important or bigger or whatever than going to the moon. What I am interested in and what I want to talk about this morning is this mode of collaboration, which one could argue, as Tim did, is unparalleled in the history of our species. But before going into that, I want to start with a little context. What I mean when I say software and what it means for software to be open source. And I also want to put out the caveat that this is sort of a complex subject, and I've done my best to get to the heart of the matter. I've not tried to oversimplify things or talk down to you all, but I have tried to condense and simplify 100 and some odd years of history into 20 or 30 minutes. And in the process, some detail gets lost. And so I want to say that not all of what I'm about to say is 100% accurate, but it is all true. So the physical element, the phone, which I showed earlier, we refer to as hardware. And the various computing devices, which we all use on a day-to-day basis, phones, even though if you don't use a smartphone, tablets, laptop computers, desktop computers, ATMs, what have you, they're really now all considered general-purpose computers. And what this means is that they, oddly enough, don't do anything by themselves. This phone, as a piece of hardware, doesn't have any intrinsic capabilities. All they have is the potential for capabilities, and they need to be told what to do. And those instructions is what we call software. The calculator is different. It has a fixed set of operations. And until World War II, this was true of really all computers. To change the capabilities of a computer, you had to go in and physically rewire the system, which is actually still true of this calculator. So as I'm sure you can imagine, that was a laborious and very error-prone process. You have to go in and re-solder things, and then you turn it on, and it wouldn't do what you wanted to do. So around 1946, right around the end of World War II, or just after, a stored program computer started to appear. And these allowed for software to be provided to the computer and stored somewhere within it. And more to the point, be replaced or augmented at a point later in time just by replacing the set of instructions, not changing the physicality of it. And interesting, at least to me, the first piece of software actually predates the ability to program a computer by over a century. In the mid-19th century, Ada Lovelace, who was a British mathematician and daughter of Lord Byron, wrote what is considered the first computer program. Now, unfortunately for Ada, she was writing software for a computer called the Analytical Engine, which was never actually built. It was all theoretical. So that was 1846. Back to 1946. The first computer programs were all written in ones and zeros, essentially the logical equivalent of doing that wiring, just expressed in a different way. And in 1952, Grace Murray Hopper, an alumni like myself and Beth of Vassar College, invented the compiler. And what this allowed was to use a higher level programming language, words, English words, and then they were translated into a form that the computer could understand. So an instruction in one of Hopper's earlier languages reads as, compare product number A with product number B. If greater, go to operation 10. If equal, go to operation 5. Otherwise, go to operation 2. Now, I've never used Flowmatic, which happens to be this language, but just hearing those words, you get some sort of sense of what's going on. It compares two things, product numbers, presumably, and then takes two different actions or operations based on the result of that comparison. And without exception, all software today is written in some kind of language, like this, and then transformed into a form that the hardware can understand. Unlike most human language, with the exception of Esperanto and a few others, programming languages all start with some sort of intentional design. Hopper started out thinking, I want to do a comparison, and I should call that compare. But beyond that, programming languages actually function very similar to human languages, whether spoken or written. A program, like any piece of text, can be considered to be written in a way that clearly articulates the author's intent, or it could be written obliquely, so the reader doesn't know what's going on at all. We talk about some programs being written elegantly and languages having their own idioms. The key thing to recognize is that when we write software, we are in fact writing for two different audiences, to use that word sort of broadly. Our programs today are written as much for other humans to be read as they are to be acted upon by the computer. My industry, computer software industry, loves this myth of the software programmer working for sleepless days on end, fueled by a steady supply of soft drinks and pizza. But this is and has always pretty much been that, a myth. Especially in the current age, it isn't practical for a single person to create, let alone maintain, a reasonably complex piece of software. If any of you have seen the film The Social Network, which is a dramatized version of the founding of Facebook, it gets a lot wrong, but in this one part is actually fairly accurate. Even the early parts where Mark Zuckerberg is writing the original code of Facebook, he's not alone. He's surrounded by other people. There are scenes where they're like all in a house together wearing headphones, but they're all together. They are alone writing. It's a solitary effort of typing most of the time, but they're in community with one another. Facebook now employs, although it started with three people, Facebook now employs over 1,000 software engineers spread all around the world. Until about 1970, there wasn't a way to buy software. All software was either bundled with the hardware, so when you bought a computer from IBM, you bought a set of software along with it, or it was custom developed within your organization. Keep in mind, we're not talking about personal computers yet. We're talking about businesses and academia, that sort of thing. And a lot of it, and the government. And if you're in government or academia, you don't really, at least at this point, have a strong profit motive. It's very different than when we have the University of Phoenix and whatnot today. There just weren't that many computers. So as a result, there weren't a lot of concerns about keeping track of who owns software. This started to change around 1970 due to market forces and government antitrust actions, which spurned the development of a separate commercial software business. And once software started to be sold, the notion of ownership and copyright became much more prevalent. And going back again to Ada Lovelace, from that time forward, there was a culture of publishing the text of computer programs in magazines and in books and whatnot. And then later, obviously much after 1840, in electronic bulletin boards, the sort of precursor to the modern internet. So by distributing the text, the source code of the program to other programmers, you could improve upon work over very long distances. So Ada Lovelace could publish her work in a magazine in Britain in 1840, and we can still read it today and republish it and improve upon it. This was a highly inefficient collaborative model, it was slow, but it was indeed collaborative. People could read the work of other people and improve upon it. In the early 80s, these two forces, the increasing commercialization and the desire for individuals to collaborate without regard for those commercial forces, collided to generate really a political movement, the free software movement. The use of free in this context was and continues to be controversial, a little bit confusing, but it is really meant in a political sense, in the sense of freedom, not price. Free software advocates are fond of saying that using the phrase free as in speech, not as in beer. And in practical terms, this sense of freedom means the ability to change software written by others, which by definition means having access to the uncompiled source code, the raw material of that software. Now, for free software advocates, despite the word free, it's perfectly okay to charge money for software. But anyone you charge has the right to change that software and either give that change back to you or to redistribute the modified software to other people, or just keep it for themselves. And if you choose to distribute your modified software to someone else, the people to whom you distribute it to have the same rights as you do. This is called a viral license because it can never be ended. That freedom associated with that text, with that source code, extends on all of those jumps of distribution. The free software movement grew slowly, very slowly, throughout the 1980s, and really almost exclusively in academia. It just wasn't feasible and a comprehensible idea outside of the academy. This started to change around 1991, in large part driven by the growth of the internet. This obviously made that collaborative model much easier and reduced distribution costs. An additional factor was that basically all of the core technologies used to power the internet were first used in the academy, as well as government, I should say. And so it was a given that there would be free software available to power the early commercial internet, really from the jump. And in the same way that free software powered the internet, it could be said that the internet powered free software. No longer did you have to print source code in a magazine, or people actually mailed tapes around to each other. You didn't have to do that anymore. People could just download the software, albeit sort of early in the early 1990s. And not everyone was thrilled with the name or the politics of free software. And in the late 1990s, there was a distinction created between free software as a political movement and open source software. Now, open source software is not explicitly political, although there are some implicitly political parts. It's really concerned about the practical matter of making the source code available without these viral license implications attached to it. And one key distinction, it's that although it's not generally possible to create non-free software out of free software, again, the redistribution always carries that freedom with it, open source software as a general concept is consistently incorporated into closed software, and this happens all the time. As an exercise later, if you look on your phone, if you have an iPhone or an Android, or this requires a smartphone, if you go into the help screen or whatever, eventually if you go down, you will find a legal section. And in that legal section is a list of all of the software that is included with it. And you will see all of these people mentioned by name. And occasionally if you Google them, if you get to their website, it'll say, "Hey, Mom, I made the iPhone." Which is very cool. Because all that is required in most of these cases is some sort of notice, a thank you message, if you will. So the day-to-day process of life in every open source project is a little bit different, but they have some commonalities. A key element is a central storage point for the project's source code, and then one or more communication channels to discuss changes, both to the source code and the project's governance. These are primarily email and chat. And one important element is that all of this is archived. All of these discussions, whether they happen in real time or asynchronously, are all stored and can be referred to later. My personal experience has largely been in the context of projects that operate under a nonprofit called the Apache Software Foundation. I actually work, not directly, but indirectly with one of the founders and several board members. And projects inside this foundation, whose motto is actually the title in the order of service, Community Over Code, have three distinct roles. There's the project management committee, the project's committers, and the project's contributors. The management committee, as the name would suggest, is responsible for the general governance of the project. Committers have the right, the privilege, to directly modify the project source code, and these are both voted upon positions. You are elected to be a member of the project management committee, and you are elected to be a committer. Contributors, for the purpose of my thoughts today are really the most interesting role, because anyone can be a contributor. The barrier is a willingness to contribute. You have to desire to do so, and no one will stop you. This can be answering, and the level of your contribution is really up to you. This can be answering questions on a mailing list, identifying troubleshooting defects or bugs, coming up with new feature ideas, really a wide variety of things. We're about to go into, although it seems impossible to imagine today, we're about to go into a project that we do every summer called Google Summer of Code, which is where university students from around the world have some idea and are effectively mentored throughout the summer. On a personal level, I think it's a terrible idea. Every summer for the rest of your life will be the Summer of Code. When you're in college, you should go do something else. But in any case, some people are very into this. And so we have people who mentor these students. That's all they do for the whole summer is mentor a college student in Singapore. And that's their contribution. So although the project management committee is ultimately responsible for the governance and well-being of the project, much like the board is in a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, the committee, as well as the committers, are expected to take the feedback of the contributors seriously. So we vote on things from time to time. And if all of the project management committee's voters vote in the affirmative, thumbs up, if a contributor, someone who's just a member of the community, votes thumbs down, their vote isn't formally binding, but it would be strange for us to move forward without at least addressing the reason for that negative vote. Community over code, the desire to build consensus, is intrinsic to the way that these projects operate. So, what does all of this have to do with Unitarian Universalism? There are a few different ways to look at this, but for me, what this comes down to is the second and fifth principles, which is to say the import of equity in human relations and the right of democratic principles. Open source projects would simply not function without a sense of equity. All are welcome to participate. The only barrier is one's willingness to be involved. Nationality, employer, social standing, age, and gender, none of that really matters. This isn't a perfect system, of course. I will not say that. Non-English speakers do struggle. We have a significant problem with that. We occasionally run into trouble with time zones, which is less of a problem. But if you can't communicate in real time because you're on the other side of the world, that's a real issue. And obviously, there's an economic element here. A lot of these people are volunteering their time, and if you're working three jobs, you just don't have the time to do that. So I will not say that this is perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it is a start, and it is a way of seeing how people can collaborate on a global level without concerns for some of these day-to-day issues. So that's ultimately what I am trying to talk about, I suppose, is this notion of global collaboration on a very large scale. On a personal level, I've worked seriously with a few of these Apache projects for about 5 years. And I've worked during that time with people from all around the world and become friendly with them, something which a decade ago I wouldn't have thought possible. Not the being friendly with them, but the meeting them in the first place. I know that there are people in India and China and throughout Europe that frankly, if I was in trouble in any of those countries, I could call up. And because we've built a relationship, I could get their help. What started as a collaborative work effort has in some cases been transformed into a real friendship. And furthermore, the result of all of that collaboration is a shared sense of ownership. So I have some handouts here. And what these are, these are files from the Apache Sling project, which is one that I've been involved with for about 5 years. You'll see my name in this. The Apache Sling project makes up, is one of the projects that Adobe Experience Manager, which is the Adobe product that I evangelize. This makes up a good chunk of it. So these are people, some of these people are people I work with. Some of these are people I only know from online. So I'm going to pass these out. You don't need to look too closely at them. So what you see here is on the left column, there's two columns because these are long files. Just look at them and then pass them around. The left column is all of the people who have contributed and their specific responsibility for that line of code. And what you see as you go through is that there's quite a few people involved. Now, not 1,300, but each line of code is really tied to a different person at a different point in time. So as you, again, as you look through there, you'll see my name. You'll see other people that I have known for 5 years and have been quite friendly with. The idea is that all of these people have a shared sense of ownership, and I apologize for making them small, but they're sort of long files. All of these people can have a sense of ownership of this work. And if you can do that in a manner where you treat people with respect and dignity, to me, that's an accomplishment that I can be proud to have been a part of. So if you want to come up and sing, here we have gathered. Thanks, Pam. So now's the time in our service where you all share your thoughts and reactions.
Thank you, Justin. I had heard about open source and software and didn't have a clue, and now I think I see a faint glimmer of light. Very interesting. I do want to ask a question. How do you weed out people who are like the trolls? Do you have a problem with people who just want to cause trouble?
No.
Okay.
You hear that happening online. I think so. From my personal experience, I think as I said, the barrier is your willingness to participate, and if you're there to cause trouble, I think that's a lot of work. That's the thing. I mean. This is beyond my talk, but I don't understand how people have so much free time to be a pain in the butt. Like, I don't. I think we do have a. I mean, to look at it a different way, how do we police our own behavior? So I'm not always the nicest person to some people. I can be too gruff sometimes, and we call each other on it. You know, there is a need. Although you endeavor to treat people with respect, sometimes not everybody does that, and you have to address that directly.
In a similar vein, I was just reminded, you said that if one person has an issue with the way that the work is going, they can flag that, and then that has to be addressed. It reminded me when Poland was an independent country, they had a parliament of 500 members, and the only way to pass an action in the Polish parliament was that the vote be 500-0. Consequently, they did nothing. You know, so it just seemed that while understandable to want to address the concerns of the people, there we go, the people that are helping write these programs, can you have people who just can stop forward motion on it by being that much of an immovable object?
So again, there's nothing that I know. I'm not supposed to answer all these questions, but it's unavoidable. So what I try to say is that it's not that if all voices need to be listened to, but they don't need to be. If you don't have a vote, in a literal sense, your vote isn't binding. So if you vote negatively, we still have to find out why you voted negatively, but we don't necessarily need to honor that directly. So it's the idea of saying, somebody voted no, let's find out why and dig into that. If out of that comes, well, we're still going to proceed, ignoring that no vote. That's okay. It's a checkpoint.
As long as it's been addressed.
Right. There's this other subtlety, which, as I was saying to Bill, when I speak normally, I have a visual element, like I do slides. This is sort of strange to me to have everybody looking at me constantly and not the visual. So I have a visual for this that you'll just have to imagine. So the voting system within Apache is plus one, zero, minus one, meaning plus is yes, minus one is no, zero is abstaining. But then there's plus zero and minus zero. And plus zero means I like this idea, but I don't love it. And minus zero means I don't like this idea, but I'm not going to stand in your way. It's somewhere between voting no and abstaining, but it's an interesting idea, and I actually find myself voting negative zero much more than I vote negative one. Like, this is not my favorite idea, but I don't feel strongly enough about it, and I can tell that you feel strongly about it, that I'm not going to stand in your way. And I think that's a really interesting idea.
Bob, I like the verse in one of James Brown's song where he says, I can dig what the new breed brings. For me, that's to a large degree bravado. I am comprehending that you have something to do with the virtual world. I've got that much. And my adventures have to do with finding technology to be a flying pain. Every time I do anything, and it almost seems, it tells me your ID is wrong, your password is invalid, and I've got, you know, my only salvation is if there's somebody I can call that's going to help me out. Otherwise, you know, I've got a three-act opera to go through to get anything done. And that's about where I'm at this stage of having to, you know, be well-rested before I turn on the computer or the iPhone or anything else and, you know, a lot of praying and hope that I can accomplish what I want to accomplish.
Hi, I'm Susan, and thank you, Justin, for doing this. I have to announce at the get-go that I'm a Luddite forever and ever, probably. But I think what I get from your talk today, and I really like it, is that I've always considered all of this stuff to be dangerous ground where we can be taken over. But what you're really presenting is looking at the glass half full instead of half empty, and I like that.
Hi, I'm Pam. A couple things. First off, thank you very much for talking about the number of people involved in the project, because I have an old copy of Adobe Photoshop, and the 15 minutes it seems like that I have to wait for all the credits to go through before the program actually powers up. But now I can like be much more appreciative of what that is. Bouncing off what Susan said, not just even that the glass is half full, but that the democraticness of this process, people become something worthwhile regardless of so many socio classes and also global classes. I'm kind of excited by the prospect of world community being now economically viable and desirable, and that this might be a way to get to a much more peaceful solution that diplomacy hasn't really found for us. There was one other thing. Oh, just thank you for having a very well-prepared service and very engaging. I actually understood this, which, you know, is a challenge. I can sympathize with what Bob is saying. My grandfather wrote once for some Christmas letter about how he grew up. And, you know, in the course of his lifetime, the kind of changes like the walking to school to suddenly having people on the moon to having a television or a radio and what a jolt that was. Can you imagine what those of us going through this period of time have seen? I don't think our children even conceive of things staying the same. You know, there's never been a time that there hasn't been change, if not every year, maybe every month, with what's new and what's being learned. So it's these are interesting times. So thank you.
Interesting times.
May you live in interesting times.
May you live in interesting times. Euphemistic.
And since Pam mentioned the Photoshop screen with all the names, this is maybe for another time. Adobe is a really interesting company. It's not alone in this regard. That it's, although it's like a regular company, that it's very hierarchical. I work for their manager, and the manager works for a director and a VP and whatever. From a cultural perspective, people talk a lot about corporate culture, but our culture is very flat. And all of those people that you see in the, like, people who wrote, contributed to Photoshop in some way, have a peer sense regardless of where they fit into the organizational structure. This week, I was in California doing a presentation for the product leads for all of those creative products. And it was great for me to be in a room where they listened to me. On a personal level, these are people whose software is used, you know, by hundreds of millions of people. And the sense of really a flatness and everyone having a voice is, that's our stuff, right? Like, that's not in the hymnal version, but in the kids version. Everyone has a voice is the phrasing of the respect for the democratic process. So it's a company and we try to make money and all of that. But the set of ideals is very similar in a sense.
Yeah, thank you, Justin. I personally have a real appreciation for what Apache does. As a lawyer, I started out with word processing with WordPerfect. And as Microsoft gradually took over the market, I was very unhappy with Microsoft Word. I felt that they always seemed to try to know better than I did what I wanted to do with their software, and they wouldn't allow me to make changes or do things that I wanted to do, whereas WordPerfect had reveal code and so forth that allowed you to do things. And I've stayed with the WordPerfect, but it's been a challenge as Microsoft has totally controlled the market. And I would be at a loss without OpenOffice, which is my way of gaining access to and working with people who insist on using Word. So it's a product that I really appreciate. But on a broader level, as I listen to you and talk about the significance of this type of collaboration, it made me think of the fact that it's really an extremely significant change that goes way beyond collaboration in the sense you're talking about. It includes it really has to do with empowerment of people over the internet by being able to communicate and cooperate. And it goes from everything to collaborative information like Wikipedia to political movements where people are able to post ballot boxes being stuffed in Russia or in Afghanistan, pictures they took of it, and people will band together to make this known and embarrass the people that are trying to hide it. So it's enormously significant and powerful change that we're going through that you're part of, and it is very much a not just a democratic, but a spiritual phenomenon of people empowering each other and working together for a common good.
Thanks, Ralph.
Sorry. No, sorry, my fault. Thanks, Justin. So as somebody in the academic community, I have a really interesting perspective on this, because even though the part of the academic community I'm in is physics and not software, still there's, you know, from as long as I've been in it, you know, from the time that I was a snotty-nosed undergraduate, right, there's been this very deep, both cultural and technological back and forth, right, between the computing community, both inside and outside academia, and the scientific community, especially in physics. We rely tremendously on a lot of the technology that comes out of, you know, essentially your sector. But it's the cultural part of it has actually been, to me, the most amazing thing, because it, in a way, if I could summarize it, it's like you know, academia has been successful in infiltrating the corporate environment and instilling an academic mindset, and in a way, it almost seems like it's worked better than it does in academia, right? Actually, you know, a lot of the same ideas that you talk about, you know, go on in the big high energy physics collaborations that I work in. The, you know, the communicating, you know, with people around the world, and you know, the way that we work on projects together. But I would say, in academia, I think, you know, as much as I try, you know, to give a sense with, you know, my students and my research group of, you know, it being kind of a flat, you know, system, and, you know, we're all peers, it's I think it's a little bit less successful than I what you have described and what I have seen in the open software world. And I have to say, I give a lot of credit, you know, that in fact, you know, your community has actually taken what is really kind of an academic approach to a problem and made it work in a corporate setting, and if anything, improved on it, right? Mm-hmm. Made it less hierarchical. I don't think, you know, all of the problems with, you know, prejudice and racial and gender disparities, they're certainly not gone in academia. I doubt they're completely gone in this community. But I actually think, you know, from what I've seen, this community does better, you know, than academia, certainly, right? I mean, we've struggled, you know, for years at Columbia trying to, you know, increase the number of, you know, women on the physics department faculty. I think the community you're in has actually been far more successful, and it's been really inspiring to see it work.
I will say, I apologize, because I think the effect of the commercial world on the academic world has been not quite as positive as the other way around.
Oh, yeah, it's actually been really, really disruptive.
So we have taken more from you than you have given to us.
Yeah.
It's not mine to apologize for, but I will.
Hi. I don't know if this is relevant, because, frankly, after you explained the difference between the phone and the calculator, you lost me. I'm very, that part of my brain is very small. But is there any, the discussion that I'm hearing and reading a lot about on the question of net neutrality, and so I don't understand that a lot either, but what I do understand is that in maximizing communication and flow of information, net neutrality is a big issue. So could you say something about that if you think it's appropriate, A, and B, if it is as important as I'm getting the sense it is, is this something that should be worth our attention as you use in the community?
Now I'll have to submit my service proposal for next year on net neutrality, because I don't. Yeah, it's a longer subject. Net neutrality is interesting because it both is and is not important at the same time. It is what. What I talked about and what's been critical to the growth of open culture is the lack of barriers, so that anybody can create a website and anybody can put content up on the internet and have that be distributed very broadly and to support collaborative models like I discussed. That net neutrality doesn't speak to at all. Nothing, no one is really talking, Verizon, Comcast, Cablevision are not contemplating shutting things down. Net neutrality, for better or for worse, is really just about prioritization. And so the idea that Netflix will be faster or slower than NBC.com, something like that. Now, that's not to say that that, you know, Cablevision's ability to slow down Netflix doesn't open the door to shutting off Netflix entirely. But at least in the near term, the net neutrality discussion is all about prioritization and who goes faster and who goes slower. So I don't sit up at night at waiting and in concern that net neutrality means that open source culture and open culture in general will die out. It is really a much more of a commercial issue to me at the end of the day. It's been interesting, I'll say, that you to see this sort of niche problem become something that people talk about and that you would bring it up is interesting in and of itself. But I don't worry about it, frankly, that much. If I was Netflix, I would worry about it a lot. But I don't know. This is a thing that you're concerned about. I know, Brian. I don't know if you...
Yeah, I worry a lot more about it. Just
okay.
Sort of the camel's nose under the tent.
It's fair.
Right, that, once it's okay to, to prioritize, right, then you have built in the possibility of, taking that a step further and abusing your ability to prioritize to actually control. And for me, I think, because my work involves, transferring huge amounts of data around the world,
right,
net neutrality may be a lot more important, because if our ability to, transfer data, a lot of our networks are not the same networks that are used for, the big cable companies. But still, once prioritization starts happening, there's more likely to be choke points, right, in the academic and university, data grids. But
yep.
I'm more worried about the slippery slope, right, that once you have a chance for, prioritization, then it admits a possibility of further abuse. But,
yeah.
We don't know, and the problem is you don't know until it actually happens.
And I think Pam alluded to this is probably to some extent a generational thing, I suppose, that it's incomprehensible to me that we would not have a state where you could publish anything. I never wanted to publish something and didn't have the opportunity to do so. You know what I mean? That was, to go back to that seems incomprehensible, but you're right, it is the camel's nose to some extent.
I've had some discussion on net neutrality with Lee's aunt, who happens to be an attorney for the FCC. And also some other people in her family who were career AT&T people who spent their time building these networks. And while I think it's certainly the prioritization is a valid issue, the reality is for the people who are actually running the backbones of these systems, there's always going to be prioritization. You have to prioritize the speeds at which stuff goes through. And it's just saying that everything gets the same access and has the equal speed is kind of a false premise. But in reality, there's the nuts and bolts of these things don't work that way.
And again, that's where I think is most important is to ensure that everything is accessible. The speed at which can vary. The idea of having universal accessibility is what, to me, is most important.
I think where the concern about
And I'll let Josh, and then I have one other thing I want to wrap on.
So you brought up initially the space program, and I was a product of that. 1968, I was 11, you know, it was very influential. One thing that I think about is also the medieval cathedrals and how they were started by a generation, and then 10 generations later, they were completed. Do you see the same thing with software like Apache, where it just lives for generation and generation and is built and perfected over time? Or do you see software more like a city, where we tear down the old to replace it with the new and discard Apache for Hopi, you know, some other form?
I don't know. I don't think we know yet. So there's I had another part that I got rid of, where I talked a little bit about how I'm not the only person that has thought of this relationship between spirituality and religion and software. There's a very influential book or essay called The Cathedral and the Bazaar, which is sort of a founding principles of free software. It was a talk and then eventually republished. And he talks about, Eric Raymond talks about cathedrals specifically, and one of the key distinctions in his metaphor of the cathedral being Microsoft and the bazaar being Linux is that in a cathedral there was an architect and a designer, or two or three people, but really it was one person's central vision. And in the bazaar you have this sense of chaos, where everyone has a voice, and that's much more the model that I see. But your point about generations is probably closer to where things are, that the core of it, or I guess it's the city in your metaphor, you know, the core of the Apache web server, which is sort of the origin point for the foundation, has been rewritten several times over, but without changing the name. Roy Fielding, who was the original author, one of the original authors, who works for Adobe now as our principal scientist or something, is a very nice guy, is still involved, but has sort of passed the baton on to other people who do more of that day-to-day work. The guiding principles are more about this community over code stuff than the particular algorithm. So I guess that makes it more of a city than a cathedral, that the design changes over time and people come up with new ways of thinking. The projects, so Sling, which is the project that I gave you the source code for, is actually much more of a metropolis model, where, so Sling is a project that contains 25 little pieces, which all do different things. And some people, me, for example, are more concerned about other of those neighborhoods, in this metaphor, than others. There are parts that I'm totally uninterested in, and parts that I'm very interested in, have a much more of a stake of ownership in. So that you can imagine as sort of a larger metro area with different neighborhoods and alleys that connect them all. So I don't know if I answered any, but we'll see in 20 years, I guess, above all.
So I was wondering during this whether you had any thoughts on whether this method would be appropriate for other areas, like, for example, social action. Like, in other words, if you had elected overseers, you know, whatever you refer to these people as, but everyone still has a voice. So in other words, I like the community over code concept in society, because, for example, we don't really have that now. Basically, what you have is philosophy over community. Like, in other words, if I blog something, then I'll get a thing that, you know, oh, government jobs are not jobs, right? It's like, because the libertarian philosophy says that, therefore no comment to the contrary of that can ever be entertained. Whereas what you're saying is the community, the health of the community is what matters, not some abstract principle. And I was just kind of wondering if that philosophy could be carried over into other types of things besides code.
So I think it's sort of similar to you know, classic New England meeting house style politics, where everybody gets together and raises their hands in a meeting hall. But I wish the answer was yes, but I fear the answer is no. I think where I for better or for worse, I tend to think that it's more useful to think about this sort of collaborative model when it comes to art than politics. I don't have a lot of hope for this sort of collaboration working for politics, because people aren't, you need to believe in the community. Like, to say community over code implies that you believe that the community is a useful thing. And I actually, sadly, I don't think we believe that. I think people, many people, I don't want to say everybody, believe philosophy is more important than community. And if that wasn't the case, then it'd be a different story. But you can't, I'm not sure how you convince people that the health of our nation, let's say, is more important than believing taxes should be low. I believe that, but I don't see the evidence to say that that's a common belief.
I love your reference to art. I agree in this respect. What appears to be chaos very seldom is. It just depends on how close or how far back you're looking at it. There's always organization, there's always structure there, no matter how confusing it might appear. I'm going to ask you about sling.
Okay.
Try to draw an analogy in the short time we've got between sling and how the fellowship runs.
No, that's my whole point, right? It's not that dissimilar. We have a management committee, a board, who are responsible, who take responsibility and are given responsibility for kind of the overall governance of the congregation, the project, what have you. We have a larger group of people. The difference between committers and contributors is not particularly relevant. You could say that the service champions are the committers, but then the congregation as a whole makes up the contributors. That we are all, as a small congregation especially, we all have a role to play. And we have this problem, not so much in Sling, but in plenty of other open source projects, of people who come in and out, who just take what they need and walk away. And what we try to do, and what we've been more successful in doing with Sling, because it happens to be a smaller project, is have people who have been engaged in the project longer than I have, for 6 or 7 years, at a fairly continual level. That maybe they may drop in once every 2 months, but they still have been around for a long time. And so their level of engagement is up to them. What we want to get out, and what they need to get out, is that ongoing level of engagement. So that may be the thing that...
Yes, that's the thing I was interested in, and the role of our ministries in that.
Right.
As pockets or centers where individuals relate inside to the whole.
Yeah, that we don't. So we, as sort of a common set of, we have a common goal in Sling, relatively common goal. We don't have a need for the committee on this and the ministry of that. That sort of structure doesn't really apply. The other difference, which is interesting to think about, is in general, when you are elected to the project management committee of Sling, you are elected for life. It is a constantly growing body. When I was elected 4 years ago, there were 6 people, and now there are 10 or 12. So it's possible to be voted off the island, but it is a very rare occurrence. It's not like a board.
Voted or run off.
People do resign. But it's not like there's a fixed number of people and it changes every couple of years. The concept, and I'm not saying that this is just how the board should run. The concept is that that the size of those organizations reflect a healthy project.
Yes.
And that other more mature projects will have 20 people. Right.
energy increases, right?
Exactly. And that there are the scope of it increases as the number of people you need increases. So that's an interesting distinction. But what I wanted to say, and well, maybe we'll do one more, about what Ralph said and actually about Bob said, is that I don't worry about net neutrality, but I worry about what Bob said, and I worry a little bit about what Ralph said, because I worry about alienation and the way that, and I don't want to pick on you, Bob, but the way that people feel alienated from these devices, which it's hard to see them going away. They are a part of our lives, and there's no turning that back. At least it's hard to see that happening. And so what concerns me is not the speed of Netflix or the ability for Brian to get his work done or the ability for me to get my work done, but that we have a substantial group of people in our society who feel alienated from something that is an increasingly important piece of the way that our society works. And I don't think that that's healthy long term. I don't know what happens, but that's what worries me, frankly. So do one more and no? All right. So we'll do Spirit of Life, 123. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard, the path is never clear, and the stakes are very high. Take courage, for deep down there is another truth. You are not alone. Thank you. Please stay for coffee.